Hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This is season 2, episode 21, where we're talking all about the first 72 hours after a personal data breach. I am joined, as always, by Katerina Santos. How are you doing, Kate?
Hi, I'm all right. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How did you find the session?
It was very, very nice. I always like to talk about data breaches. I think obviously it's a too common problem for every organization, regardless the size, regardless the nature. It's something definitely that it should be spoken more often. We did talk about very interesting topics, and we navigate a little bit like about the phases, what to do, what is risk, notify or not the individuals, the role of the ICO in these matters, and if he's doing enough. So I really, really enjoyed the session. What about you?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I mean, I always enjoy talking about risk and you know, balancing harm and protecting individuals. I mean, I think we had quite a good conversation in respect of, you know, when is a good time to identify that we need to talk to the data subjects, you know, if we don't meet the legal requirement under the law. And just talking a little bit about, you know, what the risks are of notifying them if we don't need to, and what some of the benefits are as well. So, you know, I think it was a really enlightening conversation. And
absolutely.
Think overall, you know, it was a busy session, loads of messages in the chat. We think it's a really interesting one, so we won't give too much away and we'll let you jump right in.
Thank you very much. Happy weekend.
Good afternoon, everybody, and happy Friday. Welcome to another episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Couple housekeeping bits before we get started, of course, as usual. As you guys know, these sessions are recorded. Hopefully, Miles and his lovely assistant Eve will put something in the chat in relation to the privacy notice if they can, just to let you know, of course, the sessions are recorded. We publish them on social media, websites, and Spotify and the likes and stuff like that. And then the same stuff in relation to the AI chatbots. We do take a view as the community to not have them in the session if we can avoid it. So they'll be going through and removing those as and when they see them. But if you could turn them off prior, if that's possible, that would be grand. But on that note, Kate, we are, of course, here to talk about the first 72 hours after a personal data breach. Mm-hmm. But of course, before we jump into any of these kind of things, we do like to have a quick run through the news. And I think there's been quite a few bits going on in the news, if I'm not mistaken. So is there anything that you would like to talk about?
Yes, I found like a couple of things, actually. There were like two pieces of news that already happened a couple of months ago, but now I think they are very related to this topic. So I would like just to bring your attention. I know that we already spoke with them about them a couple episodes ago, but it's about the Southport and the Nottingham attacks and then the NHS. So for the ones that were not paying very much attention to our previous episodes, reports have highlighted that there was two separate incidents involving NHS staff accessing the medical records of victims following the Southport and the Nottingham attacks. So in the Southport case, there were 48 NHS staff members that were found to have accessed the records of the victims without a legitimate reason. The affected individuals include like a 13-year-old girl and an adult teacher injured during the attack. The staff were disciplined. None of them were dismissed. There was another attack. It was in Nottingham. That the investigations found that the staff had, again, inappropriately accessed records of victims related to attacks of 2023, who killed 3 people and seriously injured 3 others. There were staff members that were dismissed. There was really several final written warnings, but none of those involved had self-reported their actions. This came from reporting. They came from our audits. No one of them came from, well, someone reporting in. The thing on the, and that obviously like actually paid my, and brought my attention, and for me was the thing that I was not just expecting was the fact that the ICO was aware of it. And did not do anything. So they just asking for more information. They were requesting more information on this case. And in the end of the day, after this happening, they decide not to take any criminal proceedings and any criminal offences and around this, which I think is, I don't know, I just feel, I feel where people were killed. I feel that when the NHS is involved, and I know that normally the all the data breaches that we are currently listening are more around cyber attacks and ransomware attacks, etc. This is more accessing files of people and documents of people that you were not supposed to be accessed. So this for me to make the point that not all the data breaches involve cyber attacks. But yeah, the same thing as well is the fact that the ICO is aware of it because it was then reported within the audits and etc. But nothing was done. And I was expecting this. So for me, I think as well, obviously the is just the fact that the ICO has no action and decides to just react potentially after seeing in the news that is everywhere, now actually is taking something on it. It's just so I don't feel comfortable.
Are they taking action now?
Now it's back in the news, yes. And now they are making an investigation.
I don't like that.
After a couple of months,
I don't even feel like I want to talk too much about the ICO today. The ICO have already put me in a bad mood this morning, as I've been reading some stuff that they've been doing. They've already put me in a pretty foul mood with some of the stuff that they've been discussing back and forth. I mean, it's odd. It is strange. It maybe might be a product of this new sort of weird approach that they're taking to the complaints that they're getting, or maybe it's a case of their priorities had shifted. But obviously, there's a little bit of a telling of things to come, isn't there? And potentially has some kind of smalling to the stuff that's happening with the actual commissioner at the moment. I'm sure you've probably all seen at the moment on LinkedIn, at least if you follow people like Tim Turner, John Baines, in relation to the commissioner and the fact that an investigation of course been happening in relation to his time within the role, and it had been found that there is a potential case to be made from the products of this investigation, which will be looked at by DSIT. That was, you know, fairly shocking to me. I'm quite surprised by that. In terms of what they're actually looking at, I'm not quite sure. And in terms of when they'll actually reach a verdict on whatever this case is, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it was awfully surprising to see that whatever has come off the back of this investigation has clearly covered some kind of issue with the commissioner being in the role that he has. And of course, he's stepping away from his duties. It seems like permanently now, whilst they have an interim Arnold, I think, who's in place at the moment.
Currently, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's hard to speculate, isn't it, what it could possibly be around, I guess, in relation to the conduct and stuff. But obviously he's accountable to Parliament himself. He's not actually employed by the ICO, I suppose, in that sort of frame of words. So it'll be looked at by DSIT, which is, yeah, I don't know,
I feel it's weird. I feel that sometimes that if you have someone from the ICO listening our episodes, you will have definitely not had like a good impression on us about talking about the ICO. But I just feel like I appreciate that the ICO, in terms of actually the regulators, when compared to others, even for example the Portuguese, etc., is very active in a sense of like the guidance and issuing that guidance, etc. I am just. For me, it's just my problem with the ICO in general, particularly the breaches, in particular when there are actually victims and people actually being killed through that actions, and they are made aware, they have the information with them, and they, even with the NHS and schools and universities and hospitals being involved, they decide not to take action until there is actually some noise in the newspapers and the journalists and stuff, and they start asking questions, and then they decide to actually make questions. And this is being seen so many times now. We just they are, instead of preventive, they are reactive. And always when someone is actually complaining or something, or someone is actually making questions. And I feel that that's exactly the opposite of their role. Is definitely exactly the opposite. They shouldn't do that.
You feel like
that.
They're just kind of forced to reconsider anyway. Maybe
absolutely.
They didn't even want to reconsider, but they kind of been...
They feel they need to.
They've been sort of boxed in, aren't they? They've been kind of pressured into a corner a little bit where it's like, well, this has all happened. What have the ICO done? Seemingly nothing. So now he's like, oh, hold on, actually, we're going to investigate this now. And I'm sure it's going to lead to something significant because of the fact that it's now in the public eye so much. But yeah, you know, the last thing you want from a regulator is to be that reactive. I mean,
to not take any actions, isn't it? He's there to protect you, to regulate.
And maybe that links with some of the stuff in relation to the commissioner, I'm not sure. But I mean, I think when you look at some of the work the ICO does, and I know we do speak not always in the best light of them, I think a lot of the stuff that they have, that they've published in terms of guidance recently and stuff like that, I've felt fairly okay with. Mm-hmm. There's been some stuff recently which felt a little bit contradictory. And, you know, which wasn't ideal. But in the main, a lot of the guidance stuff, I think, is quite good. And I think it was quite a good job of analysing a lot. I do want to say that, because I do think we can be a little bit bit hard. I think the issue potentially comes in
you
that...
You see, we don't say all the bad things about you, ICO.
my issue comes with the deliberation of some of their actions. You know, again, it's hard because I've never worked for a commissioner. Maybe I will in another life or another time. But
I really hope not, please, because that way it will not be just I was in two TV shows or TV programs. You actually will say, and I work in the ICO.
Yeah, well, maybe that's
you'll be bragging yourself so much.
The ICO makes data protection made easy podcast. Maybe that's what
exactly.
I'll do. Go join the ICO. But no, I think it's hard. And I think the reason it's hard is the difference in, I think, on the investigatory side, especially on the reactive where you get complaints in, is I think the difference seemingly of expertise between these caseworkers. I think you can really tell when you're dealing with a caseworker in the ICO who's had a lot of experience, who's very knowledgeable. And the differing of advice that they provide, the conflicting advice that they give, if you speak on the helpline as opposed to speaking to a caseworker, if you speak to another caseworker, they may deliberate differently.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we? And you know, I appreciate that the law is a not one size fits all kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm speaking to two ICO caseworkers about the exact same case, realistically, they shouldn't both have different answers, and that's.
Absolutely,
and
that's
where
why
the issue lies.
I think they probably realize that, and that's why now it's when you call them, it's so poor, it's so insufficient that they just throw you. Have you read this guidance? Have you read this? We'll send you the guidance. But I'm asking you a question. We need to read the guidance. We need to read the guidance. Oh, okay, fair enough. Thank you so much. But I feel I completely agree. I completely understand. And. But I feel, you know, like, and then we have the, when we do a report like a breach, but then we wait 2 years to actually listen to them, from them. It was actually something that happened, it was like last week. I already knew about this, but actually I never lived with one of my clients this experience. Mm-hmm. So I was not even working for DPP at the time when they reported it. And they received the letter with the decision of the ICO now, so 3-4 years
what,
ago.
After 3 years?
Yeah. So they decided now, and the response that they provided was just so that the first couple of lines were actually about the case itself, but then it was a copy and paste of a template of as a response. So they have security measures, the training, you need to have the training, you need to have security measures in place, you need to record everything and document and log, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a very evident copy and paste as a response. So that's the number one. And then the number two, it's, okay, yes, you responded 4 years later.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, they're clearing a backlog, aren't they, I think? I think I was speaking to Carl Rhodes. I'm sure people in the chat will know Carl. I'm sure Carl is here. So hello, Carl. was speaking about how he had, at the event, he'd recently had a bunch of cases that, hi Cal, had a bunch of cases that had come back as closed and stuff out of nowhere, and some stuff that he'd heard back from which had been sort of way far back, and I was in a similar boat. And so I think, and he also suspects, that in some new wave of recruitment, you know, they have this graduate scheme that they've just been talking about.
Yeah.
And then they try to get people in. And I imagine they probably had quite mass and significant recruitment that has probably led to them just like filing through all this stuff as quickly as they can and just shifting a lot of stuff under the rug, even from stuff 4 years ago, which is baffling. That's absolutely
it's too
mental.
Much. It's absolutely pointless.
In 1 week, I got 3 responses. One from almost exactly a year ago, one from 6 months ago, and one from 3 days previously. That smacks of rushing through a backlog.
Yeah, it's telling, isn't it, Carl? I think. And you know, I think there's 4 years is. I heard back from about a year, and I thought that was bad. But 3-4 years is
the speed of even at the glacial speed of some of the changes in your average organization run by boards and committees and whatever. By the time an issue is being raised from a year or more ago, never mind 4 years, your organization might have changed chief executive. It's definitely changed assurance committees. It's probably almost certainly, if it's audit driven, changed its auditors. There are no processes left to re-examine the decisions you made 4 years ago.
It's so true. That's actually very true. It's such a big time in a business, isn't it? That period of time which could lead to some significant change where, you know, I think when I heard back from them, I think they were saying, you know, we presume that you've taken mitigating measures and that this is no longer an issue. What if I didn't? I could have just not done that, you know. But thanks for the assumption, at the very least.
But you know what? Like, even with the response, and not even consider time, because the time I think is well, as Carl mentioned, and it's not consistent at all. But even the response, the content of the response is just insufficient. It's not enough, because I appreciate that. Well, majority and in the ideal world, there is always something or someone dealing with data protection, so they do know the bits and bobs that they should have in place. Obviously, if something was wrong, in principle, that something was not in place or something went wrong, happened. But then when you report it and you actually seek guidance and just try to understand how can we make it better, particularly now where ChatGPTs and AI platforms exist, that level of advice is available to everyone. So I think the expectations now from the ICO are way higher than you were a couple of years ago. Is where your response, and I appreciate it sometimes with the time and the deliverables that they have, they just need to be quick and effective. But are we not expecting like a response to actually be appropriate and adequate to the case that we are reporting to you? And I know that there are people, and I'm sure that we'll talk now, that there are people that decide to report every single breach to the ICO. And I know that that's something that, we are not the biggest supporters of that action as well. And I'm sure that we will talk about this briefly now. Sort of is that are reportable. I was expecting from the ICO a response that actually is appropriate to the case and not just a copy and paste from a template, because this one actually was serious, reportable
and
serious.
Some substance would be nice, wouldn't it?
And it's just nothing. It's just a training, security measures. Then there is explanation of what is a training on data protection, what are the security measures. But that's currently, it's information that is available in ChatGPT or in their guidance in the very FAQs, you know. We need more.
I wonder if the
that's
ICO
my,
had,
that's my mind.
Some use of AI.
That's what we need more.
I'd be curious to know that. I mean, I think, again, I'm mindful that we've got like 20 minutes left or so. So I want to make sure
we try to cover.
I mean, it's all breach adjacent, isn't it? Which is good.
Yeah.
But you know, with the intent of, I suppose, what we're looking to talk about today is really, you know, maybe the first 72 hours after a breach is a bit misleading, but you know, a breach has happened, and we've took whatever action we have. you know, what realistically should we be doing at that point? You know, for a low risk one, it's fairly easy to presume what you do there, isn't it? You know, you log it, you treat it as lessons learned. And, you know, I think there's also a slight misconception there where is, you know, it's low risk. It doesn't need to go to the ICO. That means we don't really have to do much else or additional. And I don't think that's always necessarily the case. I think, yeah, maybe there could be some cases where, you know, you just ask them to delete the email, you get the email recalled. Happy days. But what I really try to tell people to sort of get out of breaches in the process of it is you've got to try claim some benefit back from it where you can. You know, if we've had 10 breaches in the past month, all in relation to emails and the fact that the auto sort of ad have just put the wrong emails in, then, you know, I've got to be sitting back and looking, yeah, whilst that's human error and it's hard to avoid, how far can I go in not making people's lives difficult, but how far can I go in trying to not completely reduce that risk, but to reduce it in a significant enough way where we get less of them whilst we keep things streamlined, you know. Obviously, I know there's an option to remove the auto ad, which could probably be a little bit complicated in some cases because it might just streamline stuff a little bit extra than it needs to. You know, it might take a bit more time, but, you know, realistically, how much more time does it take to do that than the auto ad, I suppose? And that, in effect, is an exercise in mitigating risk. And I think we've got to look at breaches more collectively, you know, after they're done. Not just the high risk ones, not just the ICO ones, but all of them collectively. And, you know, I always like to know the people who have reported them, the teams in which they come from, how many has been in a short period of time. You know, if we're getting like really low risk stuff, but it's just really, you know, bursty, you know, maybe once a month kind of thing, it still presents a problem, but it might not flag on our radar because of how inconsistent the times are. So I think the main thing really is, you know, treating it as that kind of lessons learned always. And it's not just like, okay, we shouldn't do that, but this is what we think we can try and do to try and supplement that. Whereas in, even though it's human error, we can try and negate it as best we can. It's a difficult game, but
it's, you know, very hard. Yeah, it's really hard. I think I think that the main thing that I always like, regardless of the risk, because I think it can be tricky as well, because when we are talking about low risk, high risk, medium risk, that means that you are already, or we will do some exercise to understand the level of risk. So I think that sometimes it's just that exercise obviously is needed. But I do feel that potentially from my side of things and my clients, I do work with small organizations or organizations that do not have anyone internally to deal with things. So the normal reaction is that we have a data breach. What can we do? We need to call the ICO. We need to all of this. And the thing is just understanding, okay, first action for me is we need to contain it. We need to stop it immediately, exactly the disclosure, the access, the whatever happened, we need to contain it immediately right now. And then try to understand exactly what happened, because that will be the information that you will need to actually assess the risk and obviously inform the people, notifications, etc. But I think the panic is, I appreciate that sometimes, well, it can be serious and I understand that. But sometimes we just need to stop, understand what happened, but we need to contain the incident. And that's definitely the first thing that I always say is, okay, before what is happening, tell me what you've done to kind of mitigate what happened now. And I think that's really, really important. I feel that and I actually came back to this yesterday. There was actions that are people, because they are low risk, they feel that is no data breach, or because there is an author, for example, I sent an email to the wrong recipient, but because it was internal or a trusted recipient or a trusted party, is not a data breach. Because it was a third party, it's fine. And this is not correct. So there are the other side of coins that they just don't understand what is a data breach. They feel that it's a data breach, exactly, is a high risk ones, the reportable ones, and that is the only thing that is a data breach. Mm-hmm. It's not.
I completely get that. I mean, it's can be difficult, I guess, sometimes for people to draw the line in every aspect of a personal data breach. I think, you know, the more you spend time sort of considering and looking at these things from the top down, you start kind of questioning all sort of stuff. You know, what I find, and it's kind of a trap I find people fall in, like, when I first started the role, where everybody would be looking at, you know, the most unlikely possibilities of risk that could ever potentially occur. You know, you're looking at things like, you know, what if the data falls in the hands of a criminal who is able to hack into and do X and do Y and do Z. And I've seen it doubly, you know, both when I work on sort of around educating and training, and then doubly just sometimes with customers or people from the public who might reach out for support. And we've got to understand what the law says in respect of if it is likely. The key is always in the likely, isn't it? And I think it's great if you can take that approach where you're looking at all the potential risks that are likely to come. But I do find that sometimes maybe people tie themselves up in knots in relation to, you know, these things that may happen, yes. But in respect of if they're probable, they're probably not very probable given the context. And I think that will always be key, is I don't think you can ever really talk about the risk of something without sufficient context. You know, if you just look at a breach as a small singular statement, if someone was to tell you it like that, oh, I sent an email to the wrong person. Oh, okay, that should probably be.
What does that mean? Exactly, yeah, exactly. But what is the content of the email? Who was it there? Yeah,
exactly. And
you
know, I can't imagine that will always be the case in a lot of organizations, especially these days. But I did used to see it a couple of years ago, which was like, oh, they just sent an email to the wrong person. You know, can you advise on where we stand with that? It's like, well, I can. Yeah, no, definitely, I'm happy to do so. But I'll need to know a lot more than that. And sometimes people are surprised. It's like, oh, you want us to report them just sending this email to CCC instead of BCC? I'm like, well, yeah, because we've got to look at this factor and this factor and this factor and this factor. And it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But no, bang, absolutely bang on, Janice. It runs off of a similar matrix that we used to operate on as well, actually. I think we moved away from something that was like super formulaic. We did have a more formulaic way of doing it.
Yeah, we actually did
it was like a matrix, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a matrix.
And it spit out the residual risk score. But we found occasionally
it was missing.
It's a little bit misleading. But no, I completely understand that that sort of line of thinking. I think someone was asking a question above. Let me just make sure we didn't miss it. So in respect of from Rebecca asking about phishing emails. So if they received a phishing email that has been contained internally, we've reported the phishing email to the ICO and they deem it to be closed, or we deem it to be closed, whichever, would we then suggest reaching out to the data subjects who have been affected? What do you think, Kate?
I think normally for phishing emails, I think, again, will depend a little bit on the what is it in the click, how many people, etc. I'll probably... may, depending on the organization and the context of things, but probably I could contact the ICO just for caution, because we probably don't know the extension of the phishing and how, what was the extension of it. But I would probably not notify the individuals until I have with me investigation, the discovery kind of awareness and the investigation, then I know exactly the risk. So we do have on our side the facts, the extension, who were accessed, how many clicks were they, what did they have access to, what were the mitigation actions, what happened, how much time was between the first click until you actually addressed the question. But I will probably may not do that, because I'm a very believer of a transparency, but sometimes... I don't know. It just feels that can be a little bit chaotic sometimes as well.
Yeah.
I
sometimes have to dissuade is maybe too strong of a word, but sometimes I have to discuss with customers that it may not be in the best interest always to continually inform the data subject of data breaches, especially low risk ones. because what you then find is you find yourself absolutely caught up in then a back and forth in relation to complaints, because they read it and they presume the worst. You know, the phrase data breach has a very negative connotation, of course, in respect to the news and stuff that they're hearing. They're going to hear that. They're going to think the absolute worst immediately. And sometimes, you know, transparency is always absolutely key, and that is one of the things that I try and resonate with the most in respect to the principles and in respect to data protection as a whole.
Mm.
But I think there's a time with breaches where you have to know that informing them will likely more harm than good in some cases. If you meet the legal threshold, you have to. But it is intentionally a higher threshold, right, than informing the ICO. You know, the reason it is a higher risk to that of one mm-hmm. that would go to the ICO is because, again, it's only really to inform them because they need to take action about something realistically.
Yeah, and I mean, the purpose of the notification is not just simply to let them know that this happened, so therefore, etc. It's actually to tell them that this happened and potentially there is actually active risk, and you for you to notify them for them to protect themselves. Mm. And you are just informing them without purpose, because at the end of the day, even if these things happen, and that we are always make the point that obviously this will happen and will be a red flag if you do think that do not happen in your organization, because I'm sure that you will. But these things happen. What is important? Mitigation actions, etc. And the data subjects being notified 100% if there is actually risk to them, and there is a risk that is active, and they probably need to take some measures or some sort of actions to protect themselves from any harm, from anything else. If there isn't, even if the data breach happens or any incident happens involving obviously data subject individuals, if there is no risk, I don't see it. To be honest, I don't see the point to do it. I think potential compensation with potential solicitors coming back and knocking your door and making the point, well, this happened because you have poor measures. We are making a complaint, etc. So I think actually you will cause more harm than good making this transparent.
Yeah, no, exactly. Sarah makes quite a key point in the comments saying that you need to weigh up informing the individual based on the level of harm and you know, if they're vulnerable. The context and the nature of who these people are, and sometimes a relationship between two people, maybe an affected person and potentially the person who had identified the breach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to look as broadly as that sometimes. But, you know, especially if you work in sectors where you're likely to be working with more vulnerable people or people who may, you know, react in more adverse ways. And we've also got to consider that as well. You know, if you're in housing and you've got to work with vulnerable tenants, or you have absolutely. To work with maybe quite volatile tenants in respect of things like ASB and maybe being a little bit of a nuisance as well, you've got to weigh that. Like, is it worth telling them? Sometimes is it worth telling them because they're likely going to find out from someone else? If a data breach has happened and their partner is aware of it, you know, their wife or their husband or something like that, then should we tell them so at least they know what we're doing in terms of mitigating actions, the steps we're taking? Because we know that they're going to find out, and we don't want them to find out and be shocked and to be scared and potentially distressed. So just, you know, just because it is a low risk doesn't mean you can't. And I'd say there's some times where you probably should, depending. But again, it's a risk game, isn't it? You know, it's all a risk game at the end of the day. And we're always looking, and it's why it's so important for the DPO to be able to have that relationship with other teams, because they've got to be able to come to you with that context, and you need to be able to understand the business well enough and understand those teams well enough to fully be able to grasp that context as well. So, you know, it's a game of risk, isn't it? So it's you know, it's difficult. It's hard to say it isn't, because like everything and most things in data protection, it is
absolutely, you know, depends. It always depends, isn't it?
You know, you usually shouldn't inform them if it doesn't meet the legal requirements, but you know, there's always that little caveat to everything, isn't there, that just makes our lives that tiny little bit harder. But you know, it just means that Yeah, nothing in data protection is a blanket one size fits all kind of thing, is it?
That's why it's so nice, isn't it? But I think, you know, I think as well, something that I always like to think about a notification is always a balance as well, and understanding if for that specific situation with the individual or even myself, if I was involved, would I reasonably expect to be informed about this? Or because obviously we are not informed about everything, and I'm sure that there are loads of data breach going on with my data, etc. But is would I be reasonably expecting this to be informed about this? And as well, like when you, as you were mentioning, because Sarah's point, there is as well like the trust between the relationship between the parties, and normally when there is charities, housing associations, etc., and health sectors, education that deals with these more potentially more vulnerable individuals, there is actually this trust that there is between parties, and sometimes maybe a low risk or medium risk situation actually does not activate the fact that we need to notify the individual, but for a situation of a trust, the fact that they are more vulnerable or not, and probably the feeling on their side that they feel that the information was withheld for whatever reason, I feel it probably will be interesting to do, but it is always up to the assessing the data breach and the risk, and I completely agree with you. I feel that there should be always someone that should be always informed, that knows exactly the structure, exactly the risks, exactly the way of dealing with these issues within the organization to actually make the very informed decision.
for sure. And I guess there's an additional risk nowadays, I suppose, that is a risk that maybe wouldn't have been prior. And it's in respect to reporting to the ICO now. That in itself is, you're a little bit in no man's land, aren't you, sometimes? If you've reported a breach because you need to and you think they're going to intervene, you know, it must be quite weird knowing that you have to sit on those for sort of months at a time. You know, sometimes,
absolutely.
You know, apparently in cases, you know, things like a year.
My 4 years.
4 years, exactly. And you kind of sit with that impending doom a little bit, don't you? You know, it's going to come today. And then by the time you forget about it, that's when it comes, isn't it?
Probably nothing happened.
Has the harm happened by then? You know, people go into the ICO because, one, the ICO needs to be aware of it because they might need to do something about it. But sometimes they also go to the ICO because they need the guidance and they need the help. You know, some people aren't always in the position where, you know, irrespective of how good you are at your role, sometimes you're just like, I think this is beyond me, you know, I need something else. You know, I've exhausted every option I can think of. And I don't know where I stand.
I mean, absolutely. And I think this links super well exactly what we're talking about in the beginning of the episodes of the session, because you expect obviously the regulator to be the ultimate like point that you need to do. Is like you made a decision to report yes or no. And when you do the reporting, is because you do need not only, well, to comply with the obligation to do it, but as well because something happened and you need that guidance for you. And the fact that you are actually waiting, sit down, when the harm is being caused is a question that you always, it's a really good point. It's like the question that we need to pose is, okay, because we should be expecting from the ICO response, sure, we leave the harm then continuing, or do we actually still have the obligation to try without even have the guidance or to know what to do something as well? Because it seems like a little bit like redundant, and I feel that sometimes you are just doing the reporting just because you need to do it and to say it was reportable, we done it, that's it. I don't think that, unfortunately, we should count and can count on the ICO. It's not, I think it's part of the checklist that this is reportable, the risk was assessed, etc. But the other bits as well is, I sometimes feel that probably people do not report it because they don't want the scrutiny. They don't want the follow-up questions that potentially should happen, actually. Not sure if they do happen, but they happen from the ICO. The scrutiny, the follow-up questions, we need more information, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's a really good point that you are making. I don't think the ICO is doing enough at all.
No, I completely resonate with what you're saying, Kate. I mean, I guess, you know, because I suppose, I guess to kind of close off, I mean, if you do feel like you're in a position where you are struggling in respect of data breaches and you feel like your head is in a bit of a turn, you know, trust in this lovely community that we've been able to build for 251 episodes for now. And you know, if you are ever struggling again, I know I did mention, and don't think we forgot about the community on LinkedIn that we wanted to set up, that will be getting done in due course. All the lovely folks responsible for helping us sign that up have been doing better things, getting a tan and stuff like that. So, you know, you will hear about that.
Don't be jealous.
Certainly. No, I am jealous. That was jealous of me. It was very jaded, wasn't it? But yeah, so if you guys are struggling, you know, you rely on this lovely community we have. I'm sure there's a couple of you who are probably connections on LinkedIn, and you're all very helpful and lovely people. So I'm sure you'd be able to help one another. Super knowledgeable as well, I must add. And you know, if again, apologies, but if you do feel like you need the help of us lovely folks at Data Protection People, then feel free to reach out as well in respect of anything personal data breach related. But on that note, we'll let you jump off and enjoy your Fridays and your weekends, we hope. Anybody watching the football, enjoy, I guess, for the World Cup. First couple of games were not so bad.
Portugal.
Oh, the basketball.
I have a very good feeling about Portugal winning this World Cup.
Come on, the Knicks, Charlotte. Knicks and six. Oh. But on that note, have a great weekend, guys. And we'll see you all next week.
Oh, thank you very much. Bye. Have
Take
a good
care,
weekend.
Guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.